It's the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Lori Mack in Today for Faith. This show is about the richness of life. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. Sue Mengers was a Hollywood legend. She broke the conventional mold for women in show business and became one of the most powerful talent agents in Hollywood during the 1970s. Her client list read like a who's who of the most sought-after actors in the business: Barbara Streisand, Gene Hackman, Ryan O'Neal, Diana Ross, Michael Caine, Candice Bergen, and the list goes on. Like many ambitious young women in the 50s, Mengers started out as a secretary for a talent agent and then climbed a ladder that she made herself into the top echelon of agents and talent representatives in the country. Today, we talk with author Brian Kellow, acclaimed biographer of Ethel Merman, and New Yorker film critic Pauline Kael. He gives us the backstory of the woman who changed the business of agenting and charts show business as it evolved from New York City in the 50s to Hollywood in the 80s. His new book is called Can I Go Now? The Life of Sue Mengers, Hollywood's First Super Agent. Kellow joins us today by phone from New York. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you very much.
Brian, the beginning of your book evokes this image of madmen. You can picture New York abuzz during the post-war era. Were you influenced at all by the interest of people today in the Mad Men story, or how did you get interested in Sue Mengers?
Well, I think Mad Men was an influence only subliminally. I actually was interested in this era a long time ago. The sort of New York show business world that she was a part of in a kind of an ancillary way in the 1950s and early 60s is always something that's intrigued me a lot. There's a wonderful biography of Jacqueline Suzanne that Barbara Seaman wrote called Lovely Me. Mm. I mean, Jacqueline Suzanne was not my favorite writer by any stretch of the imagination, but I would really recommend this book to people who want a glimpse at this world, the world of Toot Shores and Danny's Hideaway and all these places in New York showbiz at that time. I would just say that this was a book that I had to be talked into doing initially. I have a spectacular agent named Edward Hibbert, who works for the very fine agency Donatio and Olson, and he has been my agent for the past three books. He's also an actor, and you probably know him best for his recurring part on Frasier. He played Gil, the restaurant critic. Edward got this idea from a friend of his named Jim DiGiovanni, and it was brought to me as a great follow-up to my Pauline Kael book, and I initially resisted the idea because I wasn't sure that there was enough to write about in a biography of an agent. Hmm. And I was dead wrong.
Well, give us a sense of who she was. What was her background?
Sue Mengers came from Hamburg. She was born there, we think, in 1932. A little hard to determine that specifically for obvious reasons. She came to the U.S. in 1938 with her parents. She was an only child. Her father was a salesman. And her mother was a housewife. And the father was also an inveterate gambler and was constantly in debt. Really, really had a terrible problem. They settled in Utica, New York, way upstate in the Rust Belt. And he had a lot of trouble putting food on the table and making a living. The mother eventually took a job as a sales lady at a department store in Utica to support the household income. But they had a very rough time. It was not an easy marriage, and Sue in particular did not get along very well with her mother. They had a contentious relationship that really lasted a lifetime for both of them. And in 1946, her father, terribly in debt, committed suicide. And mother and daughter were left on their own. They came to New York. They settled in the Bronx, and the mother got a job as a bookkeeper, and Sue began to pursue her dreams of being an actress, which didn't last very long. She did a little bit of radio work in New York, but she didn't really stay with it for long, and instead she decided she wanted to work on the other side of show business, and she got a job, a series of jobs as a secretary with big talent agencies in New York. And these were very exciting years for her. She was just breaking into the business. These were kind of, you know, the best of everything years. I quote Rona Jaffe's novel, The Best of Everything, because I think it's so emblematic of that whole era, that book. She was a young, ambitious secretary with a lot on the ball and a very, very brazen personality. And she got herself noticed very quickly by people. And she just worked her way up, and eventually in the mid-1960s, she was given a chance by a fellow named Tom Corman to be a full-fledged agent at a small company. And from there, she went to CMA, which was the forerunner of ICM and one of the great big talent agencies in the country. And her reputation just increased and intensified, both her reputation for cutting deals and signing clients and her reputation for being an outrageous personality. They all kind of went together, and her legend just began to snowball at a very early age.
She was in a man's world for sure.
Yeah.
What do you think motivated her to go beyond the ambitions of the secretarial pool?
Well, I think she wanted to be a star in her own right. I think that was the driving force. And in fact, she became one. So many of the obituaries when she died said she became more famous than many of her clients. Not really. That's an overstatement. But she did become quite famous. Agents were not known for being media personalities or being generally well known to the public, with the possible exception of Swifty Lazar. But Sue did become quite well known to the public. She even had her own segment of 60 Minutes in January of 1975. She was interviewed by Mike Wallace, and she was very proud of that. She would show it to people when they came to the house. It was almost like part of a guided tour of her home. You had to watch the 60 Minutes episode on the VCR.
I watched that. It was good.
Yeah, it's very good. It's a very good interview. It's a somewhat revealing interview, too, I think, if you know what to look for.
Yeah, say more about that.
Well, I think she's such a flirt, and she's such a seductress in it. And she's absolutely playing Mike Wallace for all it's worth. You can just tell that right. He is kind of falling under her spell.
Oh, yeah.
There's also, if you watch it closely, there's a very, very funny revelation of her ability to reinvent her own story, the story she was telling. There's a sequence in the 60 Minutes episode that's done on the set of At Long Last Love, a musical directed by Peter Bogdanovich, which came out in 1975 and failed terribly at the box office. And she's telling Peter, who was her client, that, oh, this is a wonderful project, and it's going to be fantastic, and it's all going to come true, and it's wonderful to see it coming to life. Well, in fact, she thought it was a ridiculous idea to do a Cole Porter musical starring Sybil Shepherd in 1975, when there was so much great stuff being done on the contemporary Hollywood scene, you know, really, really gritty movies that were shaping the audience in a totally different way. And so she was being a little disingenuous there, but that was all for the camera.
And it was something that she got to be very good at, too.
Yeah, very.
I'm talking with Brian Kello. He's the author of several books, including an acclaimed biography of Pauline Kael. His latest one is called Can I Go Now? It's about the Hollywood talent agent Sue Mengers. She was quite wild. She must have taken the industry by storm. She's driven, smart, bawdy. Talk a little about how she muscled her way into the industry after she left William Morris.
Well, when she came to Los Angeles in 1968, CMA sent her out to join the LA office from New York. And initially, her main duties were almost as a kind of glorified hostess. She gave parties at her home in Beverly Hills, and there were dinner parties and larger parties, too, where business was done. Mm. She would invite a director who was casting a new film. She would invite some of her star clients who might be right for the parts in the star film. She would serve comfort food, which was what she thought everybody really liked the best, and she would have pot. She'd have cocaine on the table, and often by the end of the evening, a deal had been struck. But they were always working parties. This was not just pure pleasure. I mean, in the book, there are many, many examples of what it was like to be a guest at one of these parties. You had to be on your game. I mean, Candace Bergen and Allie McGraw both told me that they were very nervous before these parties began. They would kind of meet together and shore each other up and give each other a pep talk before they'd go through the front door, because they knew it was going to be, the spotlight was going to be on them in a very real way. And they were wild. I mean, Sue was a hostess who would say anything at her dinner table. She was not politically correct at all. And she loved to say things that would shock people and throw them off balance. And pretty soon, word about these parties got around, and everybody wanted to come to them. But she was very selective. She would only allow the absolute cream of the crop. And it was that had to do with her own particular personality quirks, and I would even say pathology. She was obsessed with the idea, largely because of her own difficult background and hardscrabble upbringing. She was obsessed by the idea that she had to be surrounded only by the A-list and the celebrated. And an ordinary person kind of threatened her in an odd way, in my opinion. She was rather dismissive of ordinary people. And yet, she was deeply loved by her friends, and she had tremendous humor. And I think also tremendous generosity. But again, she reminds me a little bit of a Jacqueline Suzanne character. I remember years ago reading an interview that Jacqueline Suzanne did with Rex Reed. And she said, there are no, or I'm not quoting it exactly, but it was something to the effect of, there are no ordinary people in my books because I don't know any ordinary people. And I think that was the image that Sue Mengers had in her head, you know.
She had two lists, the A list of super successful people or
right.
The B list of losers.
Right, absolutely. And it was a very black and white worldview she had. And she followed everything very closely. She took great interest in people's developing careers and who was hot, who wasn't. She really did her homework very carefully, and not just in Hollywood, in the Broadway world, in the literary world. I mean, she was very much up on what the current best-selling novels and nonfiction were. She often had authors, popular authors as guests at her house, and she followed politics too, but in a slightly different way. I don't think she was as interested in politicians' ideology as she was on what they might be like in bed. I think that was her main focus with that. There's a funny story in the book about her introducing Governor Jerry Brown of California to her good friend Joan Juliet Buck, who was the editor of French Vogue. And it's a very, very funny story about her sort of playing matchmaker and getting very excited about it.
Can you tell it?
Joan met Jerry Brown at this party at Sue's house. And Joan told me in our interview that it was sparks flew right away. I mean, it was very clear that something was rather significant was happening here. And Sue, who was obsessed with the idea that her close women friends would latch onto some kind of security, financial security, social security, that would carry them through the years, got very excited about this. And she called Joan the next day and said, "He called me and asked for your number, Mrs. Brown. You're going to be Mrs. Brown." I mean, she was almost like a high school kid in that respect. You know, she loved putting people together and seeing what happened. Her favorite dream couple, of course, was Robert Evans, the head of Paramount Pictures, and his wife, Allie McGraw. And I think when they broke up in the mid-1970s, it was possibly even more devastating to Sue than it was to the two of them,
wow.
Because she had so much riding on it.
I want to ask you a little bit more about her childhood and how that influenced her later. But let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Brian Kello. He's author of this book, Can I Go Now? The Life of Sue Mangers, Hollywood's First Super Agent. I'm Laurie Mack, in for Faith Middleton. We'll be right back. This is the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Laurie Mack, in for Faith, and we're talking today with Brian Kello. He's the author of several books, including an acclaimed biography of Pauline Kael. His latest book is called Can I Go Now? It's all about the Hollywood talent agent Sue Mangers. We talked before the break about how she divided people into two groups, the successful people that she associated with and everybody else, which to her were losers. As snobby as it sounds, it seemed more like a defense mechanism, like a way of protecting herself. Do you think that's fair to say?
Oh, yes, absolutely, absolutely. You know, it's a funny thing when you're an agent, no matter how successful you are. I think, and this is a generalization, but I would say that you definitely belong in this world of celebrities and power brokers, and yet in another way you don't. You aren't the talent. You aren't the filmmaker. You're the person who's helped putting those things together. And, you know, as such, in a way, I suppose you're more valuable because stars fade and directors fade and you know, a lot of business people carry on from one era to another. Mm-hmm. But I think that she was, I think there was a little bit of the little girl from Utica who was always pressing her face against the glass and not really sure that she belonged.
Yeah.
Entirely. I mean, she didn't betray that very much. What she displayed was great confidence and a very, very bawdy wit and outrageous personality. But I think it was there. And I think it's difficult to escape her background completely. I think it comes up here and there, no matter how you think you've tried to tamp it down.
You mean know? With her or with anyone?
With anyone, I think. I think almost with anyone. I think it's a very hard thing to bury if you've made a huge leap the way Sue Mangers did into an entirely different kind of life. I think reminders do come up all the time of your early years and your other life. There's a wonderful story about her being invited to a performance of Death of a Salesman on Broadway with Dustin Hoffman, who was a friend of hers, and she couldn't go because it reminded her too much of her father. She was afraid it would remind her too much of her father. Mm. You know, this is a very funny book, I think, because of the material I got from all her friends and clients and colleagues. I think there are a million funny stories about her in the book, and I certainly designed the book as a kind of a comedy. But I think there's a real undercurrent of depression that balances that. I think I tried to show that anyway.
You can practically mix and match these movie stars with the top films of the 60s and early 70s. And I'm thinking here about Ally McGraw and Ryan O'Neal in Love Story, Ryan O'Neal and Barbara Streisand in What's Up, Doc?, Gene Hackman and Barbara Streisand in All Night Long, Gene Hackman in The French Connection. I'm not even scratching the surface. She stood at the epicenter of all these films, and most of them were blockbusters.
Mm-hmm.
How did she get these ready-made stars?
Well, she was very determined and very blunt and often very abrasive. She would just come up to them, say at a party or some other social gathering, and say, I think your agent is a fool, I think he's an idiot, you should be represented by me, call me, and hand the person her card.
And that worked?
Oh, it often worked. I mean, one day she was driving through Los Angeles, and she saw Burt Lancaster walking down the street, and she rolled down her window and started yelling at him that he should be represented by her. Now, he didn't do it, because I don't think somehow Sue was probably Burt Lancaster's cup of tea. I think that he was a very elegant man in a lot of ways, and I don't know that that would have worked, but it did work. And of course, you know, kind of a subtext of this book is that actors are always, at some point or another, dissatisfied with how they're being represented. Mm. Always. And if their career is in a lull, it's not their fault, it's the agent's fault. And they're I think, frequently, they're in a constant state of looking around for a better deal, better representation. I think that's still the case. And she knew that, and she knew how to play on that. And she did it quite successfully. I mean, Ryan O'Neal told me that she came up to him at a party and told him that his agent sucked, quote-unquote. And
let's not beat around the bush.
No. And I think for the most part now, since it's a far more corporate atmosphere in Hollywood than it was in the 1970s, I think they're a little more tactful than that.
Yeah, you say that about it being more corporate. It wasn't always.
No, not then. I mean, there was that element, of course. There was always that element, but in the late 60s and all through the 70s into the early 80s. Creative people were given, I think, a greater degree of leeway than they had had previously. I think that the director in the 1970s Hollywood was a revered figure, and studio heads were, you know, they were not only vying over stars, they were vying over directors in a way that I don't think they had done for a while. And some remarkable work, of course, was done in that decade. I mean, that's a decade in which I was growing up. And I remember the thrill of going to the movies back then. I mean, do you remember? Do you agree with me about
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely.
It was an event to go to a movie. I mean, I don't mean to sound like, you know, Norma Desmond or something, but it really was. There was a thrill to it that I don't think you have in quite the same way now. For one thing, movies don't have the same impact in the general culture that they did back then because there's so much competition from everything else. And I think, you know, people don't go out to movie theaters in the way they used to. They stream them. They get them on demand. It's a totally different dynamic now.
So agents probably, at this point, it wouldn't be possible for them to have the same influence that she did.
Not in the same way. I think they can have a much greater financial influence because they're trained very specifically in this area now in a way she wasn't. I mean, Sue had very little interest beyond setting the salary agreement for her client. She had very little interest in what came after that in terms of back end of the deal and percentages and, you know, she wanted to get her client $500,000 or $750,000 or $1 million, and that was sort of the end of it. There's a very, very high-level attorney in Los Angeles named Kenneth Ziffrin, whom I interviewed for this book, and he told me a very revealing story about that. He said, somewhere I've still got the memo. She sent me, Ken was representing Ryan O'Neal in the mid-1970s as a legal client. At the same time that Sue was representing him as an agent. And Sue had written out $400,000 for Ryan on the new picture, all other details to be handled by Ken Ziffrin. And that was kind of how she thought. She was interested in the broad flourish, not the details so much.
How interesting.
Yeah.
I'm talking with Brian Kello. He's the author of several books. His latest one is called Can I Go Now? It's about the Hollywood talent agent Sue Mengers. She sounded like she could have a real mean streak, and I want to get to that. But here's a sort of tame example. She hated the movie Forrest Gump, but she was happy for Sherry Lansing, who was head of Paramount at the time. And as you say in the book, Sue delivered one of her classic backhanded compliments to Lansing. She said, and I'm quoting from the book, "I hated that movie more than life itself. How could you have known to make that movie? Now I know you're a genius." What a line.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it? Sherry Lansing told me that herself.
And that was nothing.
No, that was nothing. That was nothing. She could be extraordinarily cruel to people. And she thought that it was all in the spirit of being honest with them, I think, for the most part. I think she thought she was doing them good by really leveling with them. But then again, she had very specific tastes in everything. And the films of the 1970s, they were extremely challenging. They were presenting life in a way that it had not really been presented on the screen, in a very personal way. Sometimes, you know, an almost uncomfortably personal way.
And particularly for her.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think she had an enormous respect and regard for that. And once the 80s kicked in and it became the age of Spielberg and what Pauline Kael, I think, accurately referred to as the infantilization of the audience with these sort of boys' adventure stories like, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark and E.T. and all this kind of thing, as good as those films may be technically, and they are, the whole thing changed. The audience was reshaped in a big way post-Star Wars. You know, the George Lucas and Spielberg years. And I don't think Sue had the least regard for that at all. She really didn't. She liked those tough human stories from the directors of the 1970s. And I think she was very, very sorry to see that era pass, as was Pauline Kael, as was I. And I think she always hoped that somehow it would come back. It was funny. This might be a little off the point, but when you spend this much time on a biography of someone, researching it, putting the whole life together, the person gets under your skin in a way that's very, very interesting, and you start to wander around your daily life wondering what Sue Mengers would have thought about this, that, or the other. You know, you walk into a bakery to buy a croissant and a cup of coffee, and you think, what would Sue Mengers have thought about this place? Would she have thought that it was too twee, too dressed up? Would she have liked it, you know? And yesterday, I went to see a movie that I'd heard so much about. Everybody said, oh, it's the perfect little independent film. It's a great movie. It's fantastic. And I went to see it here in New York yesterday. It's Grandma, starring Lily Tomlin. Have you seen it?
I have, yes.
And I was just kind of left so flat by it. I couldn't quite figure out what the point of it was supposed to be. And I was thinking of her. Oddly enough, as I was sitting there, I thought she would be rolling her eyes and saying, who in the hell cares about these people? You know, and that is a very funny thing. I had the same thing with Pauline Kael. I would go to a movie and I would start laughing to myself because I would sort of be imagining how Pauline Kael might have responded to it.
Brian, did you end up liking Sue Mengers?
Yes, I did. I'm glad you asked me that. Because that question is a more complicated question in this book than it has been in any of my others.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You've read the book, so you know what a tricky character she could be.
Sure.
And in spite of all that, in spite of everything, she could be, frankly, racist at times, mm-hmm. at least in word. I'm not so sure in deed. I think it was mostly done to shock people in liberal Hollywood. You know, I think she liked to sort of play with them a little bit. I don't think she really believed some of the things that she said. But in spite of her sharpness and her sharp tongue and the fact that she could be cruel to her friends at times, I did like her because I found her such an authentic person. I thought there was such authenticity about her, and I think that that's what her clients and her close friends valued in her most. There was a truth-telling about her that was very, very hard to come by in Hollywood. And I also, aside from that, I found her a very touching character. I did find her to be the little girl with her face pressed against the glass, not quite sure of how she'd gotten here. You know, and there was something about the background that I found very moving. The relationship with the very difficult mother I found to be very moving. So I did. But she is a person, I think, who is bound to make some readers uncomfortable.
Sure.
It's interesting. I've noticed it a little bit in some of the reviews of the book. It's gotten very, very good press. But underneath it, you can kind of tell they're wrestling with her a little bit. as a personality. They're not quite sure if they're supposed to give their seal of approval, you know, to her life story.
Well, she was complicated.
Very complicated.
This is biographer Brian Kellow. His book is called Can I Go Now? The Life of Sue Mengers, Hollywood's First Super Agent. Can you tell the story about her relationship with Barbara Streisand?
Yeah. Sue Mengers and Barbara Streisand had been friends for many, many years. They met actually in the late 1950s in New York before Streisand was a star. And Sue had initially represented Elliot Gould, who was Streisand's husband, in the 1960s and early 70s, and got to know her through Elliot, really. They became very, very close. They had a lot in common. They had similar backgrounds in a lot of ways. They became as close as sisters, really. And Sue did think that they were sisters, and I think that she felt that in Hollywood she had a better key to Barbara Streisand than anybody else did. She really understood her background and what made her tick. And Streisand was, of course, I think, the great talent among performers of that whole time. I think there was kind of her and everybody else. Not just as a singer. I think she could be an extraordinary actress, too. So they worked together. They eventually became agent and client. And Sue helped put together What's Up, Doc, the whole package for What's Up, Doc, the big hit comedy of 1972, because she represented both Barbara Streisand and Ryan O'Neill, who were the stars of the picture, and Peter Bogdanovich, who was the director. And it was an enormous hit,
right,
and a big milestone in Sue's own career as an agent. So things went on very happily for the most part for many, many years. And then in 1980, Sue's husband, who was a Belgian writer and director named Jean-Claude Tremont, had put together a picture initially called Night People and later retitled All Night Long. And it was a kind of an odd little comedy about people in Los Angeles who work at night. It initially starred Gene Hackman, who was Sue's client, and Lisa Eichorn, who was a rising young actress, mm-hmm, very much on a par with Meryl Streep at the time. I mean, the two of them were considered to be the actresses to watch for the future. After a couple of weeks of shooting, Lisa Eichorn was replaced, much at Sue's urging, actually, with Barbara Streisand. And suddenly this little picture that had a small budget was inflated into a big budget picture because Streisand's salary was $4 million for under a month's work.
Mm.
And in my opinion, what happened, I think it's actually kind of a nifty little movie, but I think Streisand's presence threw the whole thing off balance because this little quirky comedy was not what people expected of a Barbara Streisand picture.
Sure.
In the early 1980s. And when it was released, it flopped at the box office. Shortly after that, Barbara Streisand called Sue into a meeting and said, I think we should continue to be best friends, but I do not think we should work together as client and agent because we do not have the same taste. She had also been very put off by the fact that Sue had not supported her in her dream project, which was Yentl.
Mm.
Sue thought it was the most ridiculous idea she'd ever heard of, and she openly ridiculed it in front of Barbara Streisand. So they had a break. Sue responded very, very badly. She was very hurt by it, and she said, well, I don't want to be your friend if I can't be your agent. And there was a long cooling off between them that lasted for a number of years, and eventually they patched it up, but not to the degree that they had been close friends, you know. There was permanent damage there. I think Sue absolutely always thought that Streisand was one of the great talents of all time. I don't think she ever changed her mind about that, but she was very bitter about the breakup as friends and client and agent.
Why do you think she went that far with Streisand?
I think it was an emotional connection. I think she had an emotional reaction. I don't think she was being a level-headed businesswoman.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, you know, we've all said things to people we love and care about that we wish we hadn't, and I think that was one of those moments. And it really was a turning point in Sue's own career. I think she kind of lost heart for the business after that, and she could never really recapture her old enthusiasm. Plus, everything in Hollywood was changing so much in ways that she didn't like. But I did get to interview Barbara Streisand for my book, which was really so interesting, and I was very, very happy to have had access to her. Our mutual friend Frank Rich is the person I owe tremendous gratitude for that, because he called her and said, you should really talk to him, because she gets deluged with requests, and she doesn't do very many of them. And so I was really happy to have her side of this whole story in my book.
So what was that experience like?
She was great, I thought. She was very prepared, very meticulous. She'd done her homework. I mean, if she's going to do something, she does it right. There was a funny little moment where she was trying to remember the exact point at which Sue had taken over as her agent, because Sue had sort of been in the background for a number of years, working for Freddie Fields and David Beagleman, who were actually the men who officially functioned as Streisand's agents in the 1960s. And she couldn't quite remember the point at which that turned over and Sue became the top agent for her. And I said, well, it was What's Up, Doc, because she put the whole thing together. And there was this momentary silence, and she said, that's right. That's exactly when it was. And she, from then on, any nervousness I had kind of dissipated. And she was, I think, felt that I had done my homework and knew what I was talking about, and she was very forthcoming. And I was delighted to have her. Yeah.
I'm talking with Brian Kello. He's the author of several books. His latest one is called Can I Go Now? It's about the Hollywood talent agent Sue Mengers. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation. I'm Laurie Mack, sitting in for Faith.
You're the top. You're the Colosseum. You're the top. You're the Louvre Museum. You're a melody from a symphony by Strauss. You're a band of bonnet, a Shakespeare sonnet. You're Mickey Mouse. You're the Nile. You're the Tower of Pisa.
This is the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Laurie Mack, in for Faith. If you're just joining us, my guest today is Brian Kello. He's a biographer, and we're talking about his latest book, Can I Go Now? It's about the life of Sue Mengers, who was Hollywood's first super agent. She had the most sought-after list of clients that included Barbra Streisand, Gene Hackman, Ryan O'Neill, Diana Ross, and the list goes on. Talk about the title of the book, Can I Go Now?
Well, we went through several possible titles, and a title is very, very important to me. I have not always been happy with the titles that I wound up with, because it's kind of a negotiation between you and your publisher. And they want something that, you know, the bookstore clerks are going to know what to do with. I mean, that's one of the really concrete things in choosing a title, is you have to have somebody that indicates where it's going to be put in the store, you know,
right,
in the right place. So for Pauline Kael, it was interesting. They tried to talk me out of A Life in the Dark as a subhead, and I absolutely held firm. They wanted something more generic, and I said, no. It's very important that I have that subtitle, because it plays off the titles of Pauline Kael's own books, which kind of had these suggestive, you know, deeper into movies, I lost it at the movies, you know, When the Lights Go Down. And I wanted to play off that. I also wanted to indicate with that title that I think she was not a woman who, as brilliant as she was very keen to self-examination. Neither was Sue, for that matter. So this time around, we were debating the title, and initially I thought about calling it Kiss Kiss, because that's often how she would sign off on her telephone conversations. I thought, no, that sounds so cheap, you know. Sounds like a kind of a dime store book or something. And then my brother, Barry, suggested I'll Get Back to You, The Life of Sue Mengers. And I liked that. And I was talking then one day to David Mamet. I was interviewing him, and he asked me about the title, and I said, well, I think I'll call it I'll Get Back to You. And he said, no, that's not good. And he said, and I thought this was so interesting, He said, "Isle." L is a weak sound. You can't use that in a title. And I just kind of bought it, you know. And then I came up with Can I Go Now, because Can I Go Now is the way that she would end a phone conversation if she was bored and she felt that she'd been talking enough and not getting anywhere. She would heave a big sigh and say, "All right, can I go now?" And it also seemed to me to indicate a certain ambivalence that she had about show business, especially as the years went on.
She died in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said earlier, we're not exactly sure how old she was, late 70s, early 80s. But before her death, she ordered her entire business archive destroyed. Why do you think she did that?
Privacy. I think she was very concerned about the privacy of her clients. She took that very seriously. I do not think she felt that what had gone on specifically behind the scenes was anyone else's business. And I think that's exactly why she did it. It was not exactly the best news that a biographer could have, but I was able to get a lot of the financial information through other sources, you know, other records. But I do kind of respect that decision that she made to do that. I was very disappointed, as I said, when her assistant told me that that's what had happened. But I do understand it, and I do respect it.
Well, talk about the process of writing this book. You conducted a lot of interviews.
210.
How long did it take you to write?
I researched it for about 2 years, and then I wrote, maybe just a little over 2 years, and then I wrote it in about 1 year. Once I don't write anything until I've done as much research as I possibly can. And I have to know pretty much where I am with everything. And then I start to write. I write quickly. Writing is not usually a difficult task for me. And the writing generally goes quite quickly. And so I did it in about a year. And, you know, there are always little research side trips that you make here and there as you're settled into the writing of it. I mean, there were a couple of interviews that I got very late in the game. One was Kathy Moriarty, and one was Jack Nicholson. Who was specifically asked to speak to me after I had talked to everyone else.
And what do you make of that?
Well, I don't know exactly. Maybe he just wanted to make sure that I was really going to stay with it and that I wasn't wasting his time.
Uh-huh.
Maybe he wanted to talk to some of his other friends who had already spoken to me to see if I was on the level.
And so how did that conversation go?
Well, he was very, very charming guy, I thought, and we had a nice conversation about her. He had great affection for her. Jack Nicholson was somebody who really took very good care of Sue in her later years when her health was failing. He would take her to the doctor. He would literally carry her around places because she was quite overweight and was having manifold health issues. And I think a very loyal, devoted friend to her.
Did you know he took care of her?
Yeah. Yeah, I did. The people had told me a lot about that prior to my conversation with him. But he told me a very funny story, which the London tabloids jumped all over with glee. You know, they love any dirt on the royal family, no matter how far removed or insignificant. And there's a story in the book about, in 1979, Sue gave a party at her home in Los Angeles for Princess Margaret. And the absolute elite of Hollywood was invited to this. And Princess Margaret apparently had a wonderful time, you know, flirting with John Travolta and flirting with Jack Nicholson and all of this. Barbara Streisand was there. I mean, everyone was there. And at some point at this party, and I got this from Jack Nicholson himself, he said, "I offered an illegal substance to Princess Margaret." And Sue got very angry with me because she thought it was inappropriate. Now, he said illegal substance. The London tabloids all substituted the word cocaine.
Oh.
And I'm sure it was cocaine. But they ran big stories on this right after my book was published on September 8th, and I thought it was hilariously funny that this was the one detail in this entire fascinating life that they chose to focus on. They even called Buckingham Palace asking if they would confirm or deny the story,
wow.
Which is not bad for a boy who was born in Tillamook, Oregon.
No, you're doing quite well. I'm talking with Brian Kello. He's the author of Can I Go Now? It's about the Hollywood talent agent Sue Mengers. Sue's legacy was really interesting. She had an estate of $13 million. She left half of it to the Louvre with David Geffen's help, who was a good friend of hers.
Right.
And half to establish the Sue Mengers outpost at the Motion Picture and Television Country House and Hospital.
Right.
Can you talk about this place?
The Motion Picture Country House is a wonderful institution where aging and ailing members of the film industry go when they can't live on their own anymore. They run out of money, and it's a place where they can live very nicely in their last years. Many famous stars have lived there. I mean, Norma Shearer was there, Mary Astor was there, lots and lots of people, and. It's a great organization, and she really believed in it. And I think it was also her nod to Hollywood history. She was a great lover of old Hollywood, and I think she thought this was something she could do for a lot of those actors who had meant so much to her.
So a very fitting bequest.
Yeah, I think so. I think very, very. The one to the Louvre surprised me more, actually, but that had to do with her husband. Her husband, Jean-Claude, was Belgian. And he was a great lover of art. He was a very, very highly intelligent man who knew a lot about a lot of things. Very cultured man. And I think that was her tribute to Jean-Claude, whom she adored and felt had really made her life possible in so many ways.
Sue invested what seemed to be every fiber of her being into the film industry. What do you think drove her? Was it sheerly her desire not to be her parents?
Oh, I think that was a lot of it. I think that was a lot of it, yeah. I mean, she was a lover of celebrity, a lover of stars. And this was really the principal interest of her life. She didn't have a lot of other interests.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, after she left the business for good in 1990, those last years, I think, were often very, very difficult because she didn't have anything to replace that.
And no children.
No children. She claimed in that kind of W.C. Fields way not to like children.
Hmm.
I think she was maybe overstating that a little bit. I don't think children were ever first choice with her by any means. But I think she certainly became very friendly with the children of some of her close friends as they got older. Anthony Perkins' children being a good example. And I think she just loved the life in Los Angeles and the life in the movie business. I think it meant the world to her. And unfortunately, I think she left it too soon. She would have been far happier if she had been able to figure out how to adapt to the changes in the business and keep riding the wave. And instead, she walked away. And I think it was way too soon.
If she had any regrets about not having children, she doesn't strike me as the type who would admit it.
No. Oh, no, 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 no. She was not a sentimentalist at all. And only in her maybe most maudlin pot-induced moments, she was an inveterate pot smoker, in later years, would she occasionally say to a friend, you know, it might have been better if I'd had a kid. But I think in a funny way what she meant by that was that, because by this time her husband, Jean-Claude, had died and left her alone, I think what she may have meant by that was, then somebody would have been able to take care of me,
mm-hmm.
You know. And, of course, as you age, that is what you think a lot of times, I think.
Yeah, for
you
sure.
You know, I think that kicks in for a lot of people.
You had a good time writing this book.
Working on this book certainly was absolutely the most fun I have ever had in my entire writing career. Fun is not always a word I would use when you sit down to write a biography of a celebrated person, but it certainly was in this case. I loved every minute of it.
There are a million great anecdotes for anybody interested in the personalities of that era, not just actors, but agents, theater people, screenwriters, and on and on. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed our talk.
Me too. Brian Kello, he's the author of Can I Go Now? The Life of Sue Mengers, Hollywood's First Super Agent. I'm Laurie Mack, in for Faith Middleton. Thanks for listening.